This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel, the editor of the TLS. Joining me this week is not professional vacationer Thea Leonarduzzi, who is scandalously unwell at the moment. We hope she gets better soon. In her stead, filling the role of presenter not only due to her talent and literary heft, but also because she's a token northerner as well, is Lucy Dallas. Lucy, hello.
Hello.
I know you don't like to read the paper, so I'm very sorry you've had to do it in preparation for this podcast.
That's okay. I made a massive exception.
Did you enjoy it?
I read it this week.
You read?
No. Everybody will know that I love to read the paper.
Did you read the whole paper?
No, I didn't read the whole paper.
Did you just read the items?
Time.
Did you just read the items we're discussing now?
I read around it.
Did you?
That's what I did. Yep.
But not in the paper. Just the articles.
Some of it in the paper. I read around it from our archives as well.
That's impressive.
It's all absolutely super. I think people should subscribe.
That's great. Commercialism. Rank commercialism. That's all I'm.
It's an advertorial.
Yeah, it's all I'm interested in. Coming up on the show this week, we begin our poetry special in the paper this week with two pieces on the giant of Italian medieval poetry, Dante. Rowan Williams, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, has considered the theology of Dante, and Ian Thompson has considered how the Divine Comedy inspired the Texan maverick painter Robert Rauschenberg. Ian's going to be in the studio to discuss that. We are also lucky enough to carry a conversation with the great theatrical figure and perhaps unparalleled director of Shakespeare, Peter Brook. Our very own Michael the Dr. Keynes has spoken to him. We'll run the whole conversation as a separate podcast, but give you a 10-minute taster here. We also keep things poetical with a discussion about the unjustly neglected American poet Weldon Keyes. Who he, you might say. Mark Ford will be on hand to tell us. Midway in our life's journey, I went astray from the straight road and woke to find myself alone in a dark wood. So begins the 1954 translation of the Divine Comedy by Dante Alighieri. The words come from the American poet John Ciardi. Between 58 and 1960, the bad boy of American pop art, Robert Rauschenberg, immersed himself in Ciardi's version of the Inferno. The result was a series of pictures on the theme of damnation, one for each of the 34 cantos. Ian Thompson, in his piece this week, describes them thus: images of weightlifters taken from Sports Illustrated, golf and deodorant adverts, news media shots of John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon were superimposed onto smudgy watercolour, pencil and crayon backgrounds to conjure a 20th century Hades. Thompson has reviewed a book by Ed Kretschmer called Rauschenberg Dante, which explores the interaction between this medieval Christian poet and a Texan neo-Dadaist maverick. He joins Lucy and me in the studio. Ian, welcome to you. Can you tell us a bit about this translation that was around in the 50s? What sort of inferno would Rauschenberg have been reading when he was reading this Ciardi translation?
So this was the 1954 Ciardi translation of the Inferno. And of course, Dante's entire work is made up of three books, the Inferno, Purgatory and Paradise. And Ciardi in 54 brought out his translation of the Inferno. And I think that Kretschmer in his book suggests that this translation, which was very pared down, written in a very contemporary kind of American vernacular, somehow captured the American readership at this time, an America that was about to be torn apart by civil rights movement, by the Cold War, indeed, we're in the middle of the Cold War, and the gloom and the sort of darkness of Dante's vision of man somehow chimed in with the American readership. And Rauschenberg picked up on this translation. He couldn't understand, he couldn't read Italian. He was moreover dyslexic. But I think he saw something in this vision of fallen man that attracted him.
Because it's strange in a way for him to be drawn to Dante, because as I said in that introduction and you say in the piece, on the face of it, there's not an awful lot of points of contact between this medieval poet and this Texan maverick.
Yes, Dante is not really your average kind of pop art subject. This is a late medieval poem about the fall of man and his eventual redemption. Robert Rauschenberg, who was self-confessedly gay and also was the son of fundamentalist Christian parents, would not really automatically have been attracted to Dante. But I think, like a lot of readers of Dante, and there are millions of them in the world, it's the most translated book in Western literature, The Inferno,
is it?
After the Bible. He saw in Dante, I think, an image of every man. Somebody, an ordinary guy, an ordinary Joe who sets out in life to find himself, to discover himself, and eventually to gain some kind of insight into his state as a human being. So I think that this medieval poem appealed to Rauschenberg on that level, really, as an actually very human work.
It's really interesting when you say that because he only did the Inferno partly because that was the one that had been translated at that point, but that's the one that, because the work as a whole, Dante wanted us to get through purgatory into paradise, didn't he? The idea of the work is not that we stop and that we concentrate on hell and stay there. Very much not. And when you say it's the most translated work, is it the whole thing, or is it that everybody is interested in the Inferno and not the other bit?
I've only read the Inferno, actually.
Yeah, that's quite typical. I think most people only have ever read the Inferno. There's a sense, wrong sense, actually, that paradise and purgatory are quite dull by comparison. Paradise had its champions. Shelley, the English Romantic poet, was one of the few among the Romantics who thought it was greater work than the Inferno. But otherwise, people love the sulphurous whiff of damnation.
It's a bit like Milton, isn't it? Those are exactly. Always the fun, perceived as the funner bits.
Very much so. So tell us about the paintings. What did he do with this inspiration?
Well, Rauschenberg, who, as you said in your introduction, was a sort of bad boy of American pop art, and he was a sort of neo-Dadaist, evolved this solvent transfer technique whereby he would pour lighter fuel onto the back of magazine or newspaper images and then rub the reverse kind of vigorously with an old ballpoint pen. And what came out was this very ghostly kind of X-ray sort of transfer. Mm. So he used images from Life magazine, from sports journals, from copies of Time magazine as illustrations to his version of Dante's Inferno.
And do you like them? I mean, what do you make of them aesthetically?
I think they're beautiful. They are very, very subtle, kind of gauzy, rather discomforting, translucent works. There are 34 of them, and they're all on display currently at the Museum of Modern Art in America.
We tried to use one as a cover for the paper, but they are so translucent and sort of hazy. It doesn't work at all as a cover for, say, a magazine. It just dissipates almost into nothing.
Yes.
And they're very suggestive as well, aren't they? It's not immediately clear what's going on. You have to pay attention. And I know you say there's these figures from magazines, and sometimes you think you can map one picture onto one canto, but also there's a danger in trying to map it too directly, isn't there, I think?
Yes, there's a sense perhaps that you would enjoy the pictures more if you knew your Dante, because they're densely coded.
Mm.
And so in each of the 34 pictures, there is something there that will appeal to the Dantista, you know, the Dante expert.
Yeah.
But I think personally you don't need that at all. I mean, the images themselves are very disconcerting, as Rauschenberg intended them to be. For example, in one of the cantos, I think Canto 7 of the Inferno, which is reserved for those who have sinned against nature, there are images of fire raining down onto the desert. And of course, fire, you know, normally burns upwards. So this is a sense of perversion of nature. Of course, you know, in Dante's time, this is where homosexuals were confined to this canto.
This is Brunetto Latini, isn't it?
Yes.
Dante's teacher.
Yes, Dante's great teacher, great humanist in early 14th century Florence, is confined to that circle of hell. So Rauschenberg, as a homosexual, said, you know, I'm very upset by what Dante's done to Brunetto Latini. Nevertheless, I'm going to do my best with an image of him. And so I think he took something from a Time Life magazine and superimposed that.
Did he connect, was it images of black people? Was there an argument that Kretschmer makes in this book that oppressed people, black people in America in the 50s and gay people in medieval Italy, there's a connection there? Is that a stretch, or did you buy that as a theory?
I kind of bought it. I mean, I think that's very much the author's version, Ed Kretschmer's view. There's certainly a sense, I think, in some of these pictures that African-Americans are associated in Rauschenberg's mind with the gay community as both being exiles from the mainstream, as both being in some sense marginalized from society. But I think there's also a sense that some of the images that we see of Satan's mischievous kind of helpmates are all African Americans. So is Rauschenberg sort of betraying some sort of prejudice, very much of its time, in these images here? We don't know. Possibly yes.
And on Rauschenberg, where do you think he stands in the pantheon? Where, you know, in both of pop art and I suppose of the art canon more generally, is he a significant figure? Do you think, is he sufficiently well recognised?
Of all of Rauschenberg's work, and I don't pretend to know it very well, this, the Dante cycle, is the one that I love the most. And he worked on it for 2 years, as you said, between 58 and 60. And then in 1964, he won the Venice Biennale. And this was no doubt linked to this great cycle that he'd done on Dante. And they're not, by any stretch of the imagination, what you call pop art. They're sort of post-abstract expressionist works.
I wouldn't have even said pop art looking at them at all, would you?
No, not at all. And it was after the Biennale, wasn't it, that he then became a star, a big star that people knew about. And this
Absolutely.
Was a kind of quieter period of work, I suppose.
But the point I made about Dante interests me, about how the Ciardi piece was a Cold War Dante, it was a Dante of his time. People might say that we're living in gloomy Cold War II times. Do we think that Dante will get another look in? Will there be another translation for our times? Is there a translation for our times that exists?
Well, the most recent was by Clive James, and he is one of the very few people who had been brave or foolhardy enough to translate all three works of the Divine Comedy, to say Hell, Paradise and Purgatory.
But I like the idea. I kind of like the idea of a Dante for your times. That seems to...
Yes, there have been lots of attempts. I mean, Peter Greenaway, the film director, did his own version of The Inferno for pop video, which featured John Gielgud, I think, as a narrator. And there have been lots of attempts by Italian film directors. Pasolini, for example, wrote his own version of a modern Dante for 60s Italy. I think Dante appeals to us all, actually. He reaches out to people of whatever faiths, creeds, backgrounds. He's one of the great writers whose message has never really died.
And that's the simplicity of the narrative. I remember when I first read Inferno, the idea of a guide and a man exploring. There is something there's almost, you know, you could see a film sort of buddy movie aspect to it. There is a simple, do you know what I think?
Well, it's a lovely direct way in. Beginning. You don't have to get past a lot of context, or it's just him saying, "Well, I woke up and I didn't know where I was, and I was in a wood," and it's very quick and easy to get in, I think.
Yes, and Dante's sort of 33 then. I mean, at that time, he would have been absolutely halfway through his life.
Yeah.
So it's the way a lot of people feel when they reach their middle age mark. You know, he's lost in this dark wood. Where now?
Well, it's a really interesting thing that Rauschenberg did with it. I'm very grateful to you for. I didn't know that much about Rauschenberg and Dante together, and it's nice to bring the two together. And thank you so much for coming in now. The car of Weldon Keyes was discovered on the morning of 19th of July 1955 in a parking lot at the north end of the Golden Gate Bridge. His presumed suicide places him in the roll call of American poets who took their own lives in the middle decades of the 20th century. Hart Crane, John Berryman, Sylvia Plath, and Anne Sexton. Weldon Keyes, as Mark Ford notes in this week's TLS, is probably the least known and the least critically acclaimed of mid-century America's poet maudit. But as is also often the case, those who are aficionados have a true passion for his work. Mark has reviewed the poetry of Weldon Keyes, Vanishing as Presence by John T. Irwin, which has one of those subtitles that slightly makes the soul shrivel, but is the first monograph on Keyes's work. Mark joins Lucy and me now. Mark, before we go to the poet, I wonder, should we talk a bit about Keyes, the man? Is he a romantic figure? It seems to me that Irwin is quite taken by this idea of suicide as an aesthetic act. Is that convincing to you?
Well, there were the poets that you mentioned diced with death in their work, and one can sort of see their deaths coming to some extent, that certainly Plath, Sexton and Berryman were engaged in a kind of race against death. But Keyes's work is actually not hysterical or expressionist in that kind of way, and it doesn't. One wouldn't anticipate his dying or his suicide from it. Obviously, he was going to die, but whether he did take his own life is still. He probably did, but there were sightings of him in the decades afterwards. So some people like to think that he disappeared, that he'd done this kind of magic vanishing act, and that's what Irwin's title refers to. His work is very bleak and it's unremitting in its kind of unillusioned state, but it's not proto-suicidal like the work of, say, Plath or Berryman.
Well, let's talk about the poetry then. How would you? Because I wonder how many people listening to this will have read much Weldon Keyes. I suspect, I could be wrong, but I suspect probably not. What sort of poet would you say he was? Irwin links him to Crane and Wallace Stevens, but actually reading him this morning and reading him in the past, that didn't quite connect with me. What sort of poet do you think he is?
Well, I think in relation to those two, he is a postmodernist poet, by which I mean very literally, he comes after these modernists. And these modernists had a kind of idealistic or utopian vision of how America could be. But Keyes came after them, and his work is something of a debunking of their illusions, of their utopian vision of America, that he lived through the Second World War. He actually had a job writing the captions for newsreels from the war. So he had this terrible experience of watching these footage of battles against the Japanese and kind of writing captions to them. He was a bit of a polymath, really. He was in a jazz band. He was an abstract expressionist painter. He was interested in science. So he didn't kind of focus on any particular, though his poetry is what he's remembered for now, he was a bit of a Renaissance man. And he wasn't also, unlike those people, he wasn't seduced by the idea of fame. Truman Capote went up to him one time at a party and said, "You don't want to be famous. Why not? I can see it. You ought to be. You're better than that old Robert Lowell any day." But Keyes just was almost, he saw through fame. He saw through the kind of the capitalist hedonistic life of the 50s, and he couldn't quite believe in things. So he was, in that sense, he's close to a poet like Philip Larkin. He was a less deceived poet, and I think the bleakness of his work comes from his inability to buy into the illusions that structure other people's lives.
I was struck, but I mean, this may be wrong, and you know, you're one of these aficionados I mentioned, I think, of Keyes. It reminded me a bit of Hopper paintings, reading some of his poems, because they are very unforgivingly narrated, I think. There's a bleakness and there's a kind of removal of any distraction. It just focuses in very much down on the reality of the life it's describing.
Yeah, they are brilliant tableaus of both kind of landscape tableaus and kind of character sketches of people whose lives are often kind of deprived of meaning or who are living in some kind of terror. And the most famous of these is the character he creates called Robinson, about four Robinson poems. And Robinson sort of derives a bit from J. Alfred Prufrock in that he's a kind of bourgeois flaneur character in some of them, but he's also haunted by a kind of doppelganger who seems to incarnate some kind of terror for the character. So as in a Hopper painting, you get these kind of lonely scenes of characters isolated in rooms who are enigmatic, whose lives one can't quite fathom, but who seem to be encased in a kind of loneliness.
And it seems to me that with those figures, there is this clarity, but often there isn't necessarily anything awful happening. but the spin is very much the kind of voice is suggesting that something awful is about to happen, or perhaps something else has just happened and, you know, we're not mentioning it.
I think that's true. There's an element almost of bathos in some of the poems that if something terrible would happen, then that would be something at least.
Mm, yeah.
But there is no kind of climactic event which gives significance or some kind of narrative shape to what's happening.
There's a line you quote about Robinson, sad and usual heart, dry as a winter leaf, which I think gets to some of the things you're talking about. It's not dramatic, but it's kind of sorrowful.
That's true. And there's one where the narrator thinks he sees Robinson and he thinks that he's some kind of nightmare figure, but he's not sure that it was Robinson or whether Robinson has metamorphosed into this kind of alter ego. So it's there's a sense in which the kind of horror or terror, kind of gothic elements which are so prominent in American literature, hover at the edge of Keyes's poems without ever fully taking over the narrative.
How visible do you think a figure is Keyes now? I mean, I did an American paper at university. I don't recall him being things are a little bit misty when I think back to university, so this could just be my memory. But I don't recall him being mentioned. Is he a well-regarded, well-recognised figure, do you think?
No, I'm afraid he isn't. He ought to be, but I'm afraid he isn't. I make the point that even his best-known poems, the Robinson poems, don't make it into the Norton Anthology of American Literature, and he's not taught on courses, I wouldn't have thought. And while he has this slightly kind of cult following of particularly of poets who are very highly regarded here, such as Michael Hoffman and Simon Armitage,
yeah,
both great fans, and in America, Donald Justice, who's a wonderful poet who kind of helped resuscitate Keyes's reputation in the 60s, they are fervent admirers. Well, Justice is dead now, but Dana Joyer has taken up the mantle. In general, Keyes's work doesn't figure on courses, and he's the kind of preserve of those who like
him. And why is that? It's an interesting point. That I think it's a fascinating conversation to always consider why some authors prosper and others don't. You know, why is Jane Austen better known than Walter Scott? And there are reasons for it. But what do you think the reason is for this? Because he's not difficult. In some ways, you could say some of these poets are difficult, and you can see why they become a little bit intimidating to the reader. But he really isn't difficult.
No, his work is terrifically kind of pleasurable. And to an extent, I compared him with Philip Larkin. There's a sense in which the reader who likes Philip Larkin could very possibly like Weldon Keyes. I think there's the kind of randomness of canon formation. Also, although he disappeared, and that's exciting, his life didn't have the kind of, if you compare him with Plath or Berryman or Lowell, it wasn't as dramatic a life. And his persona is rather cool and knowing. He doesn't kind of buttonhole you or kind of press himself upon you. There's something lucid and clear, but perhaps somewhat untheatrical.
Well, and I wonder whether that's the problem, because, you know, Wallace Stevens had a very boring life. He was an insurance salesman, wasn't he, I think. And yet his work has his name resounds now very much. Is there a question that people want difficulty? They want to have a poem that they scratch their heads over because it says something about their own mental acuity, whereas something that is so accessible actually counts against it.
It can do. I mean, Wallace Stevens, I should say, was quite high up in the insurance business. He was a vice president rather than a salesman.
Sorry, I'm sorry.
He wasn't door to door. It's true that difficulty is a kind of modernist. Modernism created the notion that poetry was difficult, and in comparison with Stevens, Keyes is fairly straightforward, and certainly also with Crane or Pound. I think the kind of vagaries of reputation are very difficult to understand or to plot, and Keyes writes these poems that work very, very well in their own terms, and those who like them like them, but he doesn't somehow make sense in terms of the ways in which we chart the movement from modernism to postmodernism.
That's interesting.
So he doesn't. He's not a figure that you can sort of easily slot in.
No, I mean, I think we go from that generation. He was born the same year, or a few years before Robert Lowell. Mm. But then the generation after, Allen Ginsberg, Frank O'Hara, John Ashbery. They kind of have in some ways kind of fit into narratives of the development of American poetry, whereas Keyes always seems somehow a branch line, that he's a kind of enjoyable or extremely interesting example of a certain kind of new critical poet, you could say, but he doesn't look forward to the future in the ways in which this tribe of more experimental poets, such as Ginsberg or Ashbery or O'Hara, do.
Well, Mark, I really do hope that people reading your piece and listening to you now will take a moment to go and Google Weldon Keyes and revisit that branch line, because I lost an hour this morning doing it. It gave me an awful lot of pleasure. So thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Peter Brook is one of the outstanding theatre makers of our time. His work ranges from Titus Andronicus with Laurence Olivier in 1955, to Marat Sade in 1964, to a white box circus extravaganza of A Midsummer Night's Dream at Stratford in 1970. And that's just on this side of the channel. Peter's new book, Tip of the Tongue, draws on a lifetime of bold international work, both in Paris at the Bouffe du Nord. Is that right, Lucy?
I mean, yes, more or less.
You say it.
The Bouffe du Nord, yeah.
He's also been all over the world, as well as directing films such as King Lear with Paul Scofield in the lead role, Lord of the Flies and the Mahabharata. He is, in that sense, a master of reinvention. Brook has written in his seminal book, The Empty Space, that the slate is always wiped clean in theatre. Its impermanence marks it out from the other arts. Before we listen to our own elusive spirit, Michael the Dr. Keynes, who's spoken to Peter, Lucy, you're our arts editor.
Yes.
How excited are you about Peter Brook? What does he mean to you?
Really, really, totally excited.
Have you seen any of his stuff ever?
Yes, I've been to the Bouffe du Nord a long time ago. I'm just going to say a long time ago.
But let's not talk about your age. you always seem desperate to talk about your age.
No,
you know,
we won't talk about it this one time, Stig.
No.
And I saw he did a bunch of things inspired by Oliver Sacks's books.
Really?
And I saw a couple of things they did there.
That's interesting.
Which were just pretty wonderful. And I saw his production of Don Giovanni, which was at the Aix-en-Provence festival. A friend of mine was in it, so I managed to sneak in a couple of times.
And he didn't do that much opera, did he?
He did very little opera, and this was very unusual. It was a very pared-down cast, and he worked with the cast a lot, and it basically had no set. It was very much like any other production of Don Giovanni you'll ever see, which is full of masks and sort of curtains and foldy roll. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And this had nothing. I mean, like a chair or two and some bits of sort of cloth. Very, very minimal. It was absolutely brilliant. I mean, it was really wonderful. So it's a bit the end of Don Giovanni. It's not my favourite one, Don Giovanni, but this was one of the best things I've ever seen on stage, full stop, because it's a bit at the end when he gets dragged down into hell. And it's very difficult to do with any kind of terror, or you don't know whether to do it realistically or not. And with the best will in the world, you've got to have somebody singing their head off and also acting
while they're being dragged into hell.
All that sort of thing. And they did it with whatever it was on stage. 8 people, 10 people, and I would say 4 chairs and bits of cloth. And it was genuinely terrifying.
So really
terrifying.
Because he's credited with Shakespeare, making Shakespeare dark. So his version of Midsummer Night's Dream
Yes, I haven't seen. I've seen the pictures I've of seen that the famous picture, production.
Yeah, because he's on the swing. The fairies on a swing, swinging above the
don't
stage.
Don't they have long sort of banners and streamers for that as well?
Yeah, I think that's right. It's very exciting. So he is this great figure in the last really post-war period.
I mean, huge, and not just here either, throughout Europe.
And Michael Caine has spoken to him, and he sat down with him and asked him about the inspiration behind his new book.
Trial and error. And through trial and error, gradually, if you really go on and you produce with all your resources and all the resources of the people you work with, a whole lot of material, then gradually what's unnecessary falls away. And Gordon Craig gave this great answer when he was asked, what is your working method? And he said very simply, elimination.
Elimination.
And here we are. I'm having to answer the best I can any question you put for me. But I know quite well that if this was given to me afterwards and written, I would cut myself 2/3 of it. So that's where one has to say that there is something very subtle that can come through if we just for a moment try the best we can and then quietly let be. And then that's what the whole part of the book where I talk about letting things happen, when I talk about the formless hunch, I'd had to have gone through all the impossibilities. I had this very early on in my career when people said to me, if you're a director, a young director, you must prepare. So I took this seriously, and I sat in front of a model, and I moved the little figures right and left, and then I made little notes on the script. Take 2 steps here, right, stop, look across. And I developed a whole crowd scene that way with all sorts of things, music, indications. Had a great ball doing this. But then I came into rehearsal and just saw quite simply that none of it was any good. And I think all one needs is to be able to say to oneself, it's no good. And at that moment, things fall away. And that's what the formless hunch is about. The moment you have to work with forms, if there wasn't a form, if we hadn't a table here, I hadn't a glass of water, you haven't got a microphone, me a microphone, we couldn't be doing this. But they are not the cause of whatever good may come out of anything we say to one another. That will happen, and that's why I say the formless hunch. People get obsessed with the form, and the form is just a starting point. It's something we need. In the way I write in the book a lot about that, we need words, but words are just a form. And gradually you can find that the word is either a dead piece of useless bone, or it is vibrating because within the word there is more and more. And that's what I wrote all about Shakespeare. It's all about that. But within his words, if you come knowing what they're about, if you come and you've studied all the professors and you've read all the footnotes, you are clogged, and neither you nor the actors can go beyond a certain point. But if you say, yes, you have to prepare, and now when you come to it, you have to trust the true magic of intuition. And the intuition only comes if you've prepared the ground and if you then have the simple goodwill to stop taking yourself so seriously. And that's why working with a company is so important. Everybody at first comes with fears and egos, and that's natural, that is human life. But the rehearsal process brings you to something which eventually you need some spectators for the process to be completed, and then something more than you could have ever hoped for happens.
I'm very struck by something you wrote elsewhere, I think, about seeing Brecht. You saw his productions, didn't you?
And
they're nothing like what you expect if you'd only read his theoretical writings about theatre. Is that right?
Yeah, because He was a great theorist, a brilliant man, a very, very committed, excessively committed in politics, but at the same time, part of him had an incredible talent for what we call all the aspects of production, all the aspects of it. So when he did a production, it was no longer what he was telling people to do and what his followers did, which is to try to use the theatre to express social and political ideas. It was to bring something brilliantly, warmly, glowingly to life through images, through things like Mother Courage, which are almost mythical, and at the same time with images which demanded the best of the German theatre of his time. So he had all the, after English polite West End actors, to see those German actors where you really felt the soil of the country that they came to. So that there were massive bodies which didn't mean to search for, you know, physical expression. Mm-hmm. They had the great presence that came really from the country. And they had really wonderfully developed voices, great intelligence, and not an intelligence that was being used, as Brecht theoretically suggested, in a dialectical, analytical way. They could just enter into a part, and the actors he had, the designers he had, the music, these were all, when he came to London, for the London Theatre, it was a revelation, because there was this appreciation of the arts of the theatre, and suddenly, here beyond this great German theoretician, here suddenly was the most splendid expression of pure theatre.
There is something that appeals to you, I think, in the acting of somebody who has a cameo in Tip of the Tongue, Paul Scofield, somebody whose gift was for an absolute practical, in-the-moment kind of acting.
In the moment. I think that is the essence, in the moment. That is where theatre takes place. That's why it's so concentrated. You can take an entire life. So many plays do this. I mean, in Shakespeare's history, he does a whole cycle of history. But into his famous 2 hours traffic of this stage, he can bring together what in everyday life is 20, 30, two centuries, or in one person's life is 70, 80 years, and all of that you can feel and experience vividly and intensely, because there is this concentrating instrument called the stage, which enables you to enter into it, and you feel it within an hour and a half, 2 hours. That's why the present is what it's all about. Theatre doesn't exist. People have tried to. I've known so many university papers, which is natural for students, but they have to write for their thesis a description of plays, and I've even read things written about my productions. I read something about King Lear. I was amazed. Here was a young student who couldn't have seen something 50 years ago, but he was writing from what he had read from other people and had seen in the college library, mm-hmm. even clippings from the newspapers, and from that he was writing, and actually writing critically. And he said, but that scene wasn't as good as... And here you come to the two sides of the whole theatre. The immediateness of it, that's why, I mean, I went through the different phases of theatre in the empty space, but in the end came to the only theatre that I know that has a reality, which is the immediate theatre.
I love what you say in that book about the rough theatre. It seems you've had so many experiences of doing that, just to shake things up, to see what's going to happen.
And it's very honest, it's very good.
But it also is a way in which you are not afraid to perhaps fail. I mean, there's something in the Threads of Time about being in LA and trying to get people just to turn up to a performance, but they're all in their cars. So even techniques, as what you say about Brecht reminds me, you know, that you yourself had to adapt and learn to many different skills in the theatre, it seems.
Of course.
You just learn what you need to learn. I mean, that applies.
You learn all the way.
You learn all, exactly. Yeah. You're a learner. You can't stop and then give up on it.
Because what you've learned belongs again already to yesterday.
Exactly. I mean, you wrote about US, didn't you, and how the production, in a way, the perfect run would have been a night, because things date. I'm conscious that we are talking in a day after the death of Peter Hall, and that brings to mind all that work. I mean, to put it no more strongly than this, all that work that really changed the way Shakespeare's done in this country. Mm. And also, that I think I've read somewhere, so again, I'm acting just like that student you've just described, but I read somewhere, and you have to tell me if this is wrong, that really when you joined the Royal Shakespeare Company, it was on the condition that he gave you money for actual research, for experimenting time. That's not how it happened?
No. I came into, it was a great man who today should be honoured on the highest level, absolutely, Sir Barry Jackson. And it was Sir Barry Jackson who I was doing my first work in Birmingham with Paul Scofield, and one day he said to me, over lunch in the Station Hotel, I've just been appointed director of the Royal Shakespeare Theatre. Would you like to come with me? Well, I'm going to take my car and go over and look at it. And this fine, elegant, old-fashioned Birmingham businessman, who is a man of extraordinary polite, courteous purity, mm-hmm, and of intuition, came and looked at this quietly. We went through the different departments, and he just said, it's quite clear we must change all this. And then he just said these words that changed everything, led into the Peter Hall era and everything that I've known there. At this moment, the Shakespeare Festival is reviving old productions. There's a repertory of, and they have just 6 days to re-rehearse from last year, 6 productions. Nothing must be changed. All the actors, the comics do the same business, but they just have to re-rehearse to get back into the machine. And with that, and no, hardly ever a new production. And he said, we must have at least 4 or 5 weeks for each production, so we must construct the season differently. We can't open everything in 1 week, which is what they used to. It must be spaced out week after week, month after month, and it's so gradually a festival through the summer. And it was there that Peter Hall then took over, and it was into that that I went, still in Sir Barry's day, did my very first production, which was Love's Labour's Lost. Then I did Love's Labour's Lost, I did Romeo and Juliet, I think Measure for Measure. Peter Hall came, and he invited me to join him with a marvellous colleague, Michel Saint-Denis, very fine French director, to be a little trio running this theatre, and he asked me, very generously, typically him, would I join him? And I said, yes, on one condition, that I can also start a little experimental group paid for by the theatre, facilities given by the theatre, but which is not under the obligation to give any results whatsoever. It is research. We see that without research there can't be creation. That the word creation, which is very pretentious, and the word research is pretty pretentious, but one depends on the other as an endless in and out flow. And he said, yes, of course. And that's led bit by bit to the Marassade, and then eventually all that we did after.
Peter, thank you very much for joining us. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Peter Brook and the Dr. Michael Caines, to Ian Thompson and to Mark Ford. And my thanks go to indie pop star Lucy Dallas. You didn't think I was going to mention that, did you?
I was pretty sure you would.
Yeah, yes. I normally do. See, I find a joke that's not that funny once, I find it gets funnier the more you say it.
Super. It's not really a joke, you know, Stig.
No,
there is some kernel of truth in there.
See,
some...
you do want to talk about beats. I've lured you in then. You are a serious pop star.
I take it all back.
But thank you so much for coming on the show, Thea. We hope you get well soon. Do go to the-tls.co.uk to see this week's edition of the paper, which also contains a guide to houses in literary fiction, think Pemberley, and the Tinder of the 1940s. Please tweet this podcast at @FBFM_podcast with your comments and thoughts. Please do review us on iTunes. Next week, we'll be considering the spectre of drug addiction in all of its forms. Until then, from Lucy and from me, goodbye.